martes. El encuentro de activistas internacionales busca organizarse para la Conferencia de Naciones Unidas sobre Desarrollo Sustentable, que tendrá lugar en Río de Janeiro en el mes de junio. En el llamado Río Más 20, los gobiernos del mundo discutirán propuestas para enfrentar la crisis climática y sus consecuencias. Eduardo Andreani, de la agencia de noticias Pulsar, reporta desde Porto Alegre.
Comenzaron los debates en el Foro Social Temático de cara a Río Más 20. Este miércoles comenzaron a realizarse las actividades autogestionadas por las organizaciones de la sociedad civil presentes en Porto Alegre en esta nueva instancia del Foro Social Mundial. La principal búsqueda de este encuentro es generar reflexiones, propuestas y capacidad de movilización para la próxima Conferencia de Naciones Unidas sobre Desarrollo Sustentable, que tendrá lugar en Río de Janeiro en junio próximo. En ese espacio, los gobiernos discutirán propuestas para enfrentar la crisis climática y sus consecuencias. De este modo, durante esta semana en Porto Alegre, las informaciones e intercambios abordarán el tema con el que convoca el foro: crisis capitalista, justicia ambiental y social.
Yo no quiero dramatizar, pero la gente tiene que ser consciente que Río Más 20 es un poco o ahora o nunca.
Manuel Manoneles, de Ubuntu, el Foro Mundial de Redes de la Sociedad Civil.
Río Más 20 tiene un componente de desarrollo sostenible, de la parte de desarrollo social, que es muy importante para afrontar todos los temas de pobreza, de temas alimentarios, pero también tiene un componente clave, que es el tema de cómo afrontar el cambio climático. La otra forma que tiene el sistema internacional, que es a través de lo que se llama las reuniones de la COP, que hubo recientemente y hubo una en Dinamarca el año pasado, se están demostrando como un desastre total y no se están llevando adelante ningún tipo de acuerdo que haga posible confrontar el cambio climático. El cambio climático es el principal desafío que tenemos como humanidad en estos momentos. Hace 20 años, cuando hubo Río 92, hablamos, bueno, dentro de 30, 40 años va a pasar esto, va a pasar lo otro. Y han pasado 20 años, las cosas están empezando a pasar.
Las organizaciones presentes en Porto Alegre han manifestado sus expectativas ante la conferencia de Río Más 20, sobre todo luego de las últimas conferencias sobre el cambio climático realizadas en Dinamarca y Sudáfrica. Allí los debates entre las naciones no lograron alcanzar acuerdos ambiciosos y claros para reducir las emisiones de gases tóxicos y enfrentar el cambio climático.
Y tengamos en cuenta que ya no podemos volver a hablar, no, dentro de 20 años va a pasar esto, va a pasar otro.
Manuel Manoneles, de Ubuntu, el Foro Mundial de Redes de la Sociedad Civil.
El mismo panel de, interclimático, bueno, el panel intergubernamental y para el cambio climático de Naciones Unidas habla de un punto de no retorno que está entre el 2013 y 2017. Dice, si a ese momento no se han tomado medidas, las consecuencias que tendrá para la Tierra ya no se podrán tirar para atrás, ¿no? Entonces, no es un tema que podamos continuar debatiendo en 20 años. O en Río tomamos decisiones muy serias o lo vamos a pagar muy caro. Mucho más caro de lo que nos costaría afrontarlo tomando las decisiones en Río.
Desde Porto Alegre, Eduardo Andreani para la agencia informativa Pulsar.
En noticias de África, partidarios del líder libio Muammar Gaddafi, derrocado por las fuerzas de la OTAN, tomaron el lunes el control de la localidad de Bani Walid, al suroeste de Trípoli. Rafael Cuesta, de Colectivo Más Voces, reporta desde Madrid, España.
A plena luz del día atacaron la sede de la brigada del 28 de mayo, la más importante de la zona y la única que depende directamente del Ministerio de Defensa de Trípoli. Los asaltantes gritaban «Alá, Muammar, Libia y nada más». La víspera habían distribuido panfletos con el siguiente mensaje: «Volveremos pronto y echaremos a las ratas». El portavoz del nuevo consejo local de la localidad, uno de los últimos bastiones del viejo régimen en caer tras la ofensiva militar del pasado año, aseguró que reclamaron la intervención del ejército, pero el nuevo Ministerio de Defensa y el Consejo Nacional de Transición les traicionó y no les brindó ayuda. Se trató del ataque más grave desde la caída del gobierno de Gaddafi en plena crisis política en el seno del Consejo Nacional de Transición, cuyo vicepresidente, Abdelhafid Goga, tuvo que dimitir el domingo tras ser agredido por estudiantes que le recordaban su pasado gaddafista. Por su parte, desde la resistencia gaddafista señalan que aunque los medios internacionales no informen, la resistencia cada vez está mejor organizada, más apoyada por el pueblo, más osada y agresiva. Señalan que están firmemente decididos a vengar todos los crímenes cometidos contra el país, su independencia, contra el pueblo y su líder, y a liberar Libia del dominio imperialista. La resistencia gaddafista afirma que la toma de Bani Walid constata que la invasión de Libia será altamente costosa para los imperialistas. Afirman que la resistencia alienta el espíritu de resistencia de la vecina Argelia, del pueblo tunecino, de las masas egipcias y africanas en lucha por construir repúblicas independientes, anticolonialistas, anti-OTAN, antifeudales y antiimperialistas.
Organizaciones sociales encabezadas por la Confederación de Estudiantes de Chile entregaron a la Cámara de Diputados chilena una carta en rechazo al proyecto de ley de resguardo del orden público, conocido como Ley Antitomas. El presidente de la Federación de Estudiantes de la Universidad de Chile, Gabriel Boric, pidió a diputados y senadores no aprobar la denominada Ley Hinspeter.
Venimos a apoyar la entrega de esta carta porque nos parece que es un retroceso autoritario inaceptable. Acá se está limitando la libertad de expresión no solo de los estudiantes. Esto es un proyecto de ley que afecta a toda la ciudadanía, que busca criminalizar la protesta social y quizás más grave, cuando nosotros queremos discutir sobre los temas de fondo, queremos volver a hablar de educación, el gobierno envía estos voladeros de luces para desviar el debate de los temas importantes.
El presidente de la Federación de Estudiantes de la Universidad Católica, Noam Titelman, agregó que la ley antitomas huele a dictadura, huele a opresión y huele a represión. Por otra parte, los familiares del estudiante chileno Manuel Gutiérrez, baleado hace 5 meses por un carabinero, pidieron justicia.
La familia de Manuel Gutiérrez exigimos que el cabo Millacura, autor de los disparos que le produjeron la muerte, permanezca en prisión mientras prosigue la investigación y que sea sentenciado por el delito.
¿Qué lleva a un funcionario policial a dispararle a jóvenes a una barricada? ¿Qué lleva a hacer eso? Entonces la respuesta es que estamos viviendo en gobierno de impunidad, en gobierno que creen que pueden hacer cualquier cosa. Y el mensaje que reciben estos policías, estos que nos rodean hoy, ¿qué mensaje reciben? Que pueden hacer lo que quieran.
No, 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 no son campanas, no, no, no son de muerte, que son de vida, son todo un pueblo.
Los aspirantes a la candidatura republicana para la presidencia de Estados Unidos, Mitt Romney y Newt Gingrich, iniciaron el miércoles encuentros con líderes latinos del sur de Florida. Más de 450.000 votantes latinos están inscritos para las primarias republicanas de la semana próxima en el estado conservador. Con anuncios televisivos en español, ambos precandidatos prometen recuperación económica y derrotar a lo que llaman el régimen comunista en Cuba. Romney intenta parecer más amigable a los migrantes después de ser criticado por oponerse a reformas migratorias y proponer la autodeportación de los indocumentados. Mientras Gingrich, que triunfó en las primarias de Carolina del Sur, ha multiplicado, al igual que Romney, sus apariciones en medios en español, lenguaje al que hace años llamó idioma de los pobres. En su intento por atraer el voto del exilio cubano, Gingrich dijo en una entrevista con la cadena Telemundo que consideraría al congresista cubano-americano Marco Rubio como posible vicepresidente en caso de ganar la nominación del partido para enfrentar al presidente Obama en noviembre.
La revista Contralínea de México reporta que datos recabados sobre las concesiones mineras hechas por las administraciones de los presidentes Vicente Fox y Felipe Calderón muestran que gran parte del territorio nacional ha sido otorgado a empresas extranjeras para su explotación y con pocos beneficios para los mexicanos. Erika Ramírez es reportera de la revista de periodismo investigativo.
Está concesionada nada más y nada menos que la cuarta parte del país a transnacionales dedicadas a la explotación y exploración de minas. Esto representa 51.994.312 hectáreas del territorio nacional. Y vemos que las principales empresas que se han dedicado o que han obtenido estas concesiones vienen de capital canadiense.
Ramírez señala que los 23.000 permisos otorgados a extranjeros fueron entregados a unas cuantas compañías.
En total, las concesiones se han sido asignadas a través de 26.000 permisos y podemos ver que las principales empresas son Almaden Minerals, Diabras Exploration, Pediment y Goldcorp, además de otras.
La periodista dice que si bien las concesiones han sido hechas para extraer varios elementos, el oro y la plata parecen ser la atracción principal para esas empresas.
De acuerdo con la misma Secretaría de Economía, la exploración que están haciendo tiene mucho interés en oro y plata, esto es con 63% de las concesiones. Los demás son polimetálicos, cobre, hierro y materiales como germanio, cobalto, titanio, molibdeno. molibdeno, bismuto, estaño, platino, galio, litio, potasio, paladio, entre otros. Pero lo que nos llama mucho la atención es que el oro y la plata, lo que más les interesa a estas empresas.
Ramírez dice que desde hace años en varias partes del país se ha venido expresando un rechazo a las políticas sobre minería.
También en México ya se están dando desde hace algunos años manifestaciones en las que se niegan a la explotación de a cielo abierto de las minas. Y esto ocurre en Chiapas, en Oaxaca, en Jalisco, en Aguascalientes.
Añade que además de casi regalar a las empresas los minerales de México, el gobierno no está protegiendo a los derechos humanos de los obreros y obreras que laboran en los centros de trabajo.
Reportes de organizaciones sociales han demostrado la violación a los derechos laborales y humanos que hay por parte de las empresas dedicadas a la explotación de carbón. Vemos que no hay instrumentos de seguridad adecuados para realizar su trabajo, ni garantías de salubridad e higiene, así como pagos por horas mínimos, o sea, los salarios del pago mínimo, que es por arriba de los 50 pesos la hora, y sin protección social. Hemos visto cómo se han derrumbado minas y han decidido dejar ahí o perder las vidas humanas sin que se haga nada por estos trabajadores ni por sus familias.
Luego están las nuevas leyes aprobadas para beneficiar a las compañías mineras y la renuencia de los legisladores a cambiar las reglas del juego para que los mexicanos disfruten su riqueza, como lo ordena la Constitución del país.
Se han hecho leyes como la Ley Federal de Derecho, en la que se establecen estas cuotas que son absurdas, en donde las concesiones cuestan 5 pesos, cuando a nivel mundial la explotación de cualquier metal, el precio que tienen que pagar las empresas a los gobiernos, va de acuerdo con el material que se quiere explotar. Es decir, si el oro tiene un precio que está cada día a la alza, pues así tiene que ser el pago de las empresas hacia el gobierno. Y aquí en México no. De 5 a 111 pesos para ellos no es nada. Y esto está en una ley que los legisladores se resisten a modificarlas.
Era Erika Ramírez, reportera de Contralínea, una revista de periodismo investigativo con sede en la Ciudad de México. La entrevista completa con Erika Ramírez puede escucharse en el blog pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com, o si lo prefieren, la revista Contralínea está ubicada en contralinea.com.mx en Los Ángeles. Yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Un especial agradecimiento a la multiestatal Telesur, al colectivo Más Voces de España y a la revista Contralínea de México. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Tune in at 7 p.m. for the Great Leap Forward. This is a really good interview. You really, this guy, he is.
Cut! Take two!
Tune in on the Great Leap Forward. We have a radio station. On Free Radio Santa Cruz. What's the matter with me? I'm losing something. What is it? Oh, yeah, my mind. On the Great Leap Forward at 7 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. It's so complicated, this whole thing. I don't know if I can take it much longer. There's nothing better on free radio than the Great Leap Forward. You're going to want to gather around the radio at 7 p.m. Wednesday. Every Wednesday. If you miss one, you could perish. Yes, your life could become nothing at all. Bob's making me do this. If anyone can hear this, please come help me. He's keeping me captive. Where are the refreshments anyway? I thought there'd be chocolate covered strawberries.
After you're done, you get your treat. Get to work. I can't work like this!
Las medidas las convertirían en la policía cibernética.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathurst Piers Broadsides. We're at January 26, 2012, and counting. Special interview with Food Not Bombs co-founder Keith McHenry, hopefully coming up very shortly, live and on the phone. Stay tuned.
The economy's global, the new jobs are rotten, the factories of yore are all Superfund sites, circling the globe now in search of cheap wage slaves. We've looted the treasury and boarded our flight. Goodbye to Ron Brown, farewell dirty gringo, adios to the bosses and the corporate lingo. You won't have a name when you ride the bigger plane. CNN said they were just CEOs. Sailed with the yacht club, made more in one day than you'll earn all your life. My sisters and brothers played golf at the country club, lied in their limos till they get old and die. Goodbye to Ron Brown, farewell dirty gringo, adios to the bosses and the corporate. All of us are immoral, our tactics illegal, our resources depleted, it's time to roll on. 6,000 miles to that Croatian border, we chased our martinis, Dom Perignon. Sides of our mouth, we lied just the same. Goodbye to Ron Brown, farewell dirty gringo, adios to the bosses and their corporate lingo. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. CNN says they are just CEOs. Blinded by weather, it crashed in the snow. Who are these fat cats all scattered like sewer rats? CNN says they are just CEOs. Now is this the best way to exploit the world's workers? Is this the best way we can pocket the dough?
When the underlying events are so sad. I agree. I heard there were empty seats on that plane.
And that was the bastardized version of Deportee, I think it's a ballad by Woody Guthrie, and it's It's been bastardized by, have you been to jail for Justice singer Anne Feeney? And well bastardized, I might add. Name of that, what did she call it? CEOs is what she called it. I liked it. I hope you did too. Anyway, you're tuned to 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrob Spears Broadsides. I'm just going to scramble to catch up here. I'm a little late in the studio, so I'm kind of piecing myself together. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning, expecting a call from activist, world traveler, author, jailbird, cook, cats and jammer, Keith McHenry, as I call him. Nobody else does, but that's my name for him. Based on the famous, actually little-known comic strip, but famous in the 20s, the Katzenjammer Kids, because he's such a merry mischief maker, and yet such a determined and deep soul, really concerned with basic human rights and income disparities, and the issue, kind of put very briefly and very succinctly and very truly, food, not bombs. Established all kinds of food not bombs throughout the world, not him personally, though he runs all over the place supporting them and writing about them and cooking for them, going to jail for them if necessary, which has happened to him repeatedly. Most recently, I think he got picked up on a warrant on the East Coast somewhere, but he spent a number of days in jail in Orlando, Florida, fighting the Orlando Thou Shalt Not Feed laws that were, to some extent, successfully challenged by the Orlando Food Not Bombs. Actually kind of forced the mayor to establish a zone in front of the city hall where people could feed so as to get them away from the fancy park that they were in before. And actually, the Orlando Food Not Bombs liked that spot, and I don't think they've continued their protests at the earlier park, although there is a law in Orlando that makes it illegal to feed more than twice a year in any particular park. And even if you get a permit for it, you can only get a permit twice a year for any particular park in Orlando. I think there are 48 parks or some such thing, or not sure. It's a way of cutting back on the organizations like Food Not Bombs, which essentially are political organizations that are challenging the priorities of the city government, of the national government, of the state government, of the community, because they're saying food, not bombs. And they also often serve vegetarian food. They make food from produce and other stuff thrown away by groceries or discarded. They turn it into tasty meals, or at least edible meals. not bad. I don't say necessarily the Joe Schultz, India Joe's quality, but, the tasty. Food Not Bombs is being reestablished in Santa Cruz, I understand, under the leadership of Casey Livingood, who's struggling to do 100 different projects, some with Occupy Santa Cruz, some with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, some with Food Not Bombs. He's got a number of people working on that with him. In fact, I actually, I believe they're cooked today, if I'm not mistaken, and every Thursday they cook. Let me look at my notes on this, if I can give you more of an accurate, at least rendition of his report at the last HUF meeting, which we had yesterday. HUF meets every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa at 10 o'clock at 7:03 Pacific. Let's see here. Food Not Bombs. I don't see the times, but I believe, remembering from a previous entry here, that it was Thursdays. But I guess maybe, who knows, if anybody wants to call in, and I should be announcing that call-in number, and I will now. It is 427-3772. That's the number we're hoping that Keith McHenry is going to be calling in on. And there is another number, 469-3119, that you can also try to call in on if you want to announce something here on Free Radio. If you have some comments on anything I'm saying, if you want to sing a little song, perhaps, compete with Anne Feeney, I don't know, that might be a feat or something to that effect. Let's see here if we get the latest Yeah. I don't know if we're going to actually find when the Food Not Bombs is happening. Though I did write it down. I know that. The question is, of course, where did I write it down? And that's always a mystery, or sometimes a mystery anyway. So, yeah, I think it's Thursdays, cooking at 11, and they cook at the house that is across from Denny's. It's a kind of a collective. It's got a name that I have forgotten. I'm going to continue to scroll through here, and maybe I'll find it. Yes, here we go. Thursday cooking at 11 and serving at 4 p.m., and somebody else at the Huff meeting mentioned their free dinners every Friday for those of you who are still hungry out there and are wondering where to go but somehow found your way to a radio or a computer. The Shabbat House at Cardoff and High, and then Hobbit House also has a free meal. According to Dan, a new activist who showed up at the Huff meeting yesterday, and he's apparently, these are, I think, Jewish organizations or houses of worship, if you will. He used the little too respectful term for superstitious structures, as I call them. But sometimes, you know, religious folks in the course of their religious rituals are interested in more helping, more interested in real equity and helping people person to person and recognizing that poor people are really people, believe it or not, just not just eyesores or embarrassments or potential spare changers to avoid on the street, which, you know, something all of us who have any money often, you know, have to confront when we walk through downtown Santa Cruz or anywhere else where there are poor people around. Is not just even if people aren't asking for money, the, you know, the question is always there. Yeah, here I am, you know, I'm out here, you're over there, you know, what's the deal? So, again, the call-in number here is 427-3772. Keith sometimes gets occupied, gets arrested, gets forgetful, and so he may not be calling in. Also, I got to the studio a few minutes late, not very late, a minute or two, but I don't think he's... he probably hasn't called in yet. Maybe he'll be calling soon. That would be good if he does. I'm going to take another musical break. I like Anne. Hopefully you'll find her as much fun as I do. Or I don't know. I just she's got a good voice. She's got some good lyrics. I got to say, though, these lyrics are 20 years old. But however that may be, the same process is taking place of CEOs seizing the money of... the rest of us get to watch as they fly on their nice, you know, champagne flights and so forth. And that hasn't ended. And therefore, it's contemporary, current, and worth listening to. Let's hear a little more of Anne.
South of the border. They used to sing corridos by the Rio Grande, and every singer told of his adventures bold, back in the times when Pancho Villa and Zapata rolled. South of the border, how the times have changed. Maquiladora plants along the Rio Grande, and the song they sing is just a money thing that will leave you in the morning without anything. Your lover is a gringo from a northern land. He will promise you like he promised me. All he'll ever give you is a one-night stand. See how he's treated me. Shines. The flowers come to bloom beside the Rio Grande. They find a job that pays below the living wage. They'll wither in the sun before they come of age. South of the border, It's like the Love Canal. Maquiladora plants pollute the Rio Grande, and their only care is for the profits there. We will soon be like their other lovers everywhere. Your lover is a gringo from a northern land. He will promise you like he promised me. All he'll ever give you is a one-night stand. See how he's treated me. South of the border, in the loving tongue, they used to sing corridos by the Rio Grande. And every singer told of his adventures bold, back in the times when Pancho Villa and Zapata rolled. Your lover is a gringo from a northern land. He will promise you like he promised me. All he'll ever give you is a one-night stand. See how he's treated me.
And that's maquiladora. In case you're wondering what a maquiladora is, here's what the Wikipedia says about it. It's a manufacturing operation in which a factory imports materials and equipment on a duty-free and tariff-free basis for assembly, processing, or manufacturing, and then re-exports the assembled, processed, or manufactured product, sometimes back to the raw material's country of origin. A maquila is also referred to as a twin plant or in-bond industry. Most maquiladoras are in Latin America, but such arrangements also exist in other countries with legislation in place to enable them. Currently, about 1.3 Mexicans are employed in about 3,000 maquiladoras. A maquiladora in the Spanish language refers to the practice of millers charging a maquila or a maquila or miller's portion for processing other people's grain. And the Mexican government launched the maquiladora program called the Border Industrialization Program to solve the problem of rising unemployment along the border. The maquiladoras became attractive to the U.S. firms due to the availability of cheap labor, devaluations of peso, and favorable changes in the U.S. customs laws. The NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, favorably impacted the growth of maquila plants. During the 5 years before maquila, the maquila employment had grown at the rate of 47%. This figure increased to 86% in the next 5 years. In the 1970s, most maquiladoras were located around the Mexico-U.S. border, but by 1994, these were spread in the interior parts of the country, although the majority of the plants were still near the border. Although the maquiladora industry suffered due to the early 2000 recession, maquiladoras constituted 54% of U.S.-Mexico trade in 2004, and by 2005, the maquiladora exports accounted for half of Mexico's exports. And it faced competition due to the rise of other countries, the availability of cheap labor like Malaysia, India, and Pakistan. And then there's China's special economic areas. The point of the song, I think, is its low wages and long hours. They attract foreign investment by cheap labor, which puts together goods that then could be sold at a higher profit, of course, which is what capitalism is all about. She was talking about environmental. Ann Feeney, the singer, was singing about environmental concerns, dense population of the maquiladoras, the inability of Mexico's environmental regulatory program to keep up with the rapid growth of the industry, contributed to major economic problems. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency reports that only 91 of the 600 maquiladoras located along the Texas-Mexico border have returned waste to the United States since 1987. Mexico's waste imports have nearly doubled in recent years, and most of the waste comes from the United States. In Mexico, some maquiladoras lack proper waste management facilities and the ability to clean up disposal sites, which is why some of the hazardous waste is illegally disposed of. Environmental hazards associated with some maquiladoras include polluted rivers, contaminated drinking water. According to the Southwest Consortium for Environmental Research and Policy, all streams and rivers in the border region have been ecologically devastated as a consequence of the maquila industry. Furthermore, the U.S. Geological Survey, the State of California, and the Imperial County Health Department have all asserted that the new river, which flows from Mexicali near the border to the Salton Sea in California, to be the dirtiest river in America. Ongoing exposure to toxic waste can contribute to health problems such as cancer, skin disease, hepatitis, and birth defects. Furthermore, Mexico does not have any laws requiring industries to publicize basic environmental data on their operations, and so Mexico does not keep a very accurate inventory of hazardous wastes. And this is an interesting article. Continues briefly on Wikipedia. Again, I can't vouch for its accuracy, but, well, you be the judge. There are footnotes here. You can reference it and check it out yourself. So, this is still Free Radio, 101.3 FM. I'm still Robert Norris, and the name of the show is still Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And you can reach me still at 831-427-3772. I'm going to try to get Keith to give me a call. And I think the way I'm going to do that is give you yet another tune by Ann Feeney, and then I'll be back.
A small thing once happened at school that brought home a question for me. Somehow it taught me to see the price that I pay to be cool. Diane is this girl that I know. She's strange, like she doesn't belong. I don't mean to say that that's wrong. We don't like to be with her, though. So when we all made a plan to have this big party at Sue's, most kids at our school got the news, but no one invited Diane. Well, the thing about to have junior high is secrets don't last very long. I acted like nothing was wrong when I saw Diane start to cry. I know you may think that that's cruel, it doesn't make me very proud. I just went along with the crowd, it's sad but you have to at school. You can't pick the friends you prefer, you fit in as well as you can. I couldn't be friends with Diane, 'cause then they might treat me like her. In one class at Taft Junior High, we study what people have done. With gas chamber, bomber, and gun in Auschwitz, Japan, and My Lai. I don't understand all I learn. Sometimes I could sit there and cry. The whole world stood idly by to watch as the innocent burned. Like robots obeying some rule, atrocities done by the mob. All innocents doing their job. What was that for? Was it cool? The world was aware of this hell, yet how many cried out in shame? What heroes And who was to blame? The story that no one dared tell. I promise to do what I can to not let it happen again. To care for all women and men. I'll start by inviting Diane.
And that was Ann Feeney. Again, another one from her album, Have You Been to Jail for Justice? And it was called Courage, also Diane. Well, now that I've been able to adjust my spectacles and see that the phone line finally has been cleared, we have a guest on the air, the notorious and much beloved and sometimes roly-poly Keith McHenry. Are you roly-poly these days, Keith?
Oh, no, I'm losing weight rapidly.
Uh-oh. Cancer, bad diet, no money, too much exercise, what's the deal?
Just like traveling endlessly and not spending any time doing any eating. So, but that's cool. I need to lose weight. So.
Well, aren't you a cook?
Yeah. I mean, you just don't have time to eat when you're doing these occupations. There's just way too many people needing food immediately. It's been pretty amazing.
Well, let me do the frilly thing before we get into the meaty substance, which is always, you know, how many times you've been arrested and why is Occupy disappearing off the mainstream map and all that. But what is your favorite dish, Keith McHenry?
Oh, wow. You know what I really like to do is the dish that I make a lot that I like that's just for personal eating is lasagna with seitan and almond cheese. So that's pretty cool.
Are you going to? I understand you're coming to Santa Cruz. Are you be throwing a special lasagna dinner for the hungry, the poor, and possibly the 1% in case you want to get a few donations?
It'll probably be something different. It's hard to feed a lot of people lasagna unless you've got good equipment, and I really don't have the equipment for that. But maybe if somebody has, like, kitchens with stoves and stuff, we could do that. That would be cool.
Now, the last time you were in Santa Cruz was, what, some time ago, yeah?
Yeah, it's been years. I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago. Hmm. And I may be back in. There's a I haven't got a recent email from this thing called the Food Challenge or something, and that's about the 17th, 18th, and 19th of February. So I'm hoping to hear soon about that. But that's at UC Santa Cruz, and it's a conference of students that are organizing for under the principle that everyone deserves food, that it's a right and not a privilege. So I'm hoping to participate in that. So that could be my next time, and then I'm in the Bay Area again towards the end of March, speaking at the Anarchist Book Fair, and it would be great to set up another presentation in Santa Cruz, and I'm hoping to do something over in San Jose, and then I'll be going further north up to, ultimately, through Vancouver and Victoria, and then over to the G8 NATO protest in Chicago in mid-May, about May. I'm hoping to be there around the 11th or so, 10th or 11th of May.
So it's you and Amy. And you and Amy Goodman traveling all over the world, but she's got a bigger entourage than you do, and probably more comfortable means of transportation.
Yeah, and probably money. That sounds good. It sounds like your radio station.
Our radio station is flailing away here. I think we got enough for another month or two, and then we're down the tubes, everybody. If you want Free Radio to continue, time to, you know, go online to freakradio.org and kick down bucks. Otherwise...
Yeah, you know what I used to do for San Francisco Liberation Radio, which was really fun, and you could probably do this. I used to call up Jello Biafra and have him on for about free speech. And our only annual fundraiser was on the weekend of President's Day weekend. And we called to send in your dead presidents with dead Kennedys co-founder, Della Biafra, and then he went to a whole scene about that. And speaking of Biafra, you know, there's like a new war there. And, you know, I have a lot of friends over there. And it's kind of freaky, man. It's like a total all-out, like huge bombings in what was called Biafra, in the main city of what was Biafra during the Biafran Wars.
Now, Biafra, of course, was once a part of Pakistan. Is that right?
No, this is actually this is a part of Nigeria.
Oh, I'm thinking of another. And, that's right. Yeah, there was a civil war there for late '60s, early '70s.
It was one of the worst famines. That's where Della got his name. At the time he was he adopted that because the idea of Jello and Biafra and brutal war where it's, literally, I guess, a couple million people, I believe, starved to death in that. And people are concerned. You know, I'm getting emails from friends in Nigeria who are very, worried that this is going could escalate even worse in a way than the Biafran War, because there was actually lines. There was a front line where the war was, and now the nature of the war that's currently happening is it's all over the whole country. And I was actually kidnapped early on in a round of Christian Muslim warfare that was happening on a much lower level when I was in Nigeria last time, and I happened to get picked up by a gang that they call Area Boys at the a day after Christians had killed a. Well, the media there originally was saying 100 Muslims, but after they cleaned up the mess and stuff, it turned out to be 17 people were confirmed dead in that assault. But the last bombings that happened last week in the area that used to be called Biafra is almost 150 people killed in huge multiple bombings and shootings and stuff. So that's really absolutely horrible.
Well, maybe you can get Obama to intervene with troops. What do you think?
Yeah, he could do that. But the nice thing, he just has made this mention that they're going to, this was a cool thing about the military budget. They increased the military budget by quite a dramatic amount, and then they reduced it by a little bit. And therefore, they are saying that they reduced the military budget. But they're saying that they just increased it.
They're saying the rate of increase. They've reduced the rate of increase. It's increasing, but it's not increasing as fast. So we should all be happy.
Right. It's not as correct. Right. And then they were estimating it would have increased a lot faster and all that. It's really insanity. But it's still nonetheless over 500. $500 billion.
Well, can you review? I'm going to skip here and kind of in my usual interruptive fashion.
Yeah, no problem.
Jump in here. I will. Don't worry. and I'll try to give you an opportunity to at least get a few words in. You know, it's always useful to have your guests say a thing or two.
Cool.
Can you review the last year of Food Not Bombs? What's been happening? What you consider the high points of the year and what you see coming up in the year ahead? I mean, it's obviously a lot of it. We've talked a lot about Occupies, and that may, obviously be a big part of it. But, run through me what you think are the most important and significant events of the year, because that's not going to be in your new book, because it's too recent for your book. And your new book, of course, is Hungry for Peace? Or is that your old book, and you're working on a still newer book?
Oh, I am working on newer books, but Hungry for Peace is the one that is just currently out. And I'm actually working on one about the occupations and another about surveillance, and I'm writing a chapter in a compilation of about the occupation on the issue of food and the occupation. But the it's been and then eventually I'm going to do something on the on a rough history of Food Not Bombs and 180 pages or less, something like that. But in the year, the big highlight, of course, was originally for Food Not Bombs, was the April 12th decision by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia, to rule that our rights to free expression were protected under the First Amendment, and that we could speak four times a year in Orlando, and that that was our legal right to go out and share food with people if it was over 24 and get a permit to do so four times every 12 months in the downtown designated area, which had, had a certain number of I think 42 parks in all. And so then on June 1st was the first arrest for people sharing food in violation of that. The town actually gave us something like five or six permits and then eventually gave up and then started arresting people on June 1st. And June 1st actually was supposed to be the kickoff of a series of occupations at outside of city halls throughout Florida to protest the fact that this law not only was in Orlando, but that other cities had also decided to pass similar laws, even crazier laws like St. Petersburg and Tampa, which give you the right to share free food outside exactly zero times for 12 months. And I don't know how they thought that was going to hold up if, you know, they were being so nice with the Orlando case. But anyway, we ended up with about 24, 25 arrests in for sharing food in violation of the large group feeding ordinance in Orlando. And then that freaked out the mayor.
Before you, go on, Keith, let me interrupt you because I think there was one city in the United States that joined in this June 1st occupy, should we say, or at least sleep outside City Hall. That was.
Wait, did you guys do that? That
yeah,
was
Santa Cruz was the one city.
In fact, cool.
Yeah, I was. I actually slept out myself. I deigned to come out of my room and come down and actually I slept in my car right there, and the police ignored us, but they didn't. And that was organized by Casey, who is now.
Cool.
He's organizing, of course, a Food Not Bombs here in Santa Cruz. I mentioned it earlier in the year before I had you on, and we're trying to find out. I guess he cooks today, or they are trying to cook today. Maybe they talked today about cooking. I'm not sure if they're going to. They were going to feed in front of Taco Bell's, Taco Bell, which is an area where police take a particular interest in, should we say, I don't know, they regard it as a high drug area or a high bicycles go through the stop signs area. I'm not sure what the story is in Santa Cruz. It's at Mission Pacific and Laurel Streets, for those who are listening and are from Santa Cruz. He did do a protest, and the next day, his protest continued, the next night, I should say, and he was there alone, and the police did ticket him for the crime in Santa Cruz, which is illegal to do, as sleeping after 11 o'clock at night, which a lot of tickets have been issued for sleeping, though mostly under the more serious code section of 647E and state California code lodging, claiming people are not just sleeping, but they're planning to set up a whole industry of habitation there, and that then that's up to 6 months in jail, and actually, now it's up to a year in jail and a $2,000 fine, thanks to laws passed by the California legislature last year that made it worse. Go ahead, Keith.
Now, it's my understanding that law was originally, I think, even using the same number, but I may be wrong about that, back in the Depression. And you can read about its enforcement in books like The Grapes of Wrath and so on. It's really... you know, the wave of anti-lodging laws and all kinds of laws used against the, you know, people that are low income. There was one of the earliest waves of that was in the 30s, and
when the IWW was staging its protests around the 1910-11-12
movement.
When the unions were organizing in the 1880s and the Western miners were organizing in the 1890s, and before, I mean, I think it's a cyclical thing that happens. It's like an ongoing class war that happens.
I think the 647 groups of them were specifically for like all the Okies moving in and trying to attack them. But yeah, they definitely filled all the jails in California repeatedly for violating, or basically for this free speech movement at IWW. That was like really major assaults, and definitely there's been, and then in the 40s, the San Francisco police shot at labor organizers, and on you know, dock worker strikes.
And of course, here in 2012, they're still issuing these citations. One man, Gary Johnson, is currently in jail for sleeping outside the courthouse. He kept coming back. They issued a lot of 647E tickets against the Occupy people who were also not even sleeping outside the courthouse, but just, you know, assembling there. And some of them were sleeping, some of them were simply there, standing there. They had structures, and then they also had blankets, and mainly they had political signs. But this Gary Johnson is now in jail on $5,000 bail, awaiting trial. Judge Gallagher refused to release him on his own recognizance. And he's sitting in Watsonville, playing checkers with the folks down there in the Watsonville jail. So remember Gary Johnson, folks.
Oh, my goodness.
And free Gary Johnson.
Yeah, and then you have the other case that's a pending case is, of course, of our friend, the Commander X, Christopher, who was accused of, and maybe he's admitted to it, I don't know, but from my perspective, he's been accused of doing this whole protest to disrupt, like, Universal Studios' website, the mayor's website in Orlando, in solidarity with us being arrested over there for sharing food. So that was another Santa Cruz-based action in solidarity with the people in Orlando that are being arrested and held there. And so there's a lot of Santa Cruz connections to the defending the right to share food in Orlando or in the world. And in the last couple of days, I received an email from a woman named Kathy, and she was threatened with 6 months in jail and a $500 fine for handing out bologna sandwiches in Daytona Beach, Florida. And she actually was so upset by it, she made a petition and is trying to get 1 million signatures to send to the Republican guy that's the head of the House, I forget the guy's name, Cantor or something like that, and so she's trying to get all these Americans to sign, or anybody to sign this petition, 1 million signatures. It's linked on the front page of foodnotbombs.net, and I'm trying to encourage her. We get a lot of these emails from random citizens who have been shocked that it's actually laws restricting the sharing of free food. Many of these laws are in California, but a huge number of them are in the South. Also, Myrtle Beach Food Not Bombs has been in a political struggle there, where they made a law based on the Orlando law, and they start to enforce it after the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruling, and they were just facing arrest. One volunteer, a homeless person who eats with them and also organizes with them, was arrested in the day before the Republican debates in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So it's an ongoing, increasingly crazy situation. On the another area in the last 30 days that's been pretty crazy in the United States has been Obama's signing of the Defense Authorization Act, which did a number of things, increased military spending to $600 and some billion. It also created a really harsh embargo against Iran, which looks like it's egging Iran and Israel into a war, or it could be Israel's and egging Iran into a war, Iran digging Israel and the U.S. into war. It's like, could be seen in any of these multiple directions. And but at the same time, and Chris Hedges and a number of people have been commenting about this, that bill also allowed the military to detain anyone anywhere in the world, but including Americans, it was made clear, could be detained in anywhere in the U.S., which is an unusual aspect of this law, and held permanently without trial.
But wait a minute. Now, hold it, Keith. You haven't looked at the fact that our president, Obama, threatened to veto this bill until it was altered that allowed him or any future president to exempt those who were truly worthy of not being declared unprivileged enemy belligerents, which is Obama-ese for the Bush phrase, enemy combatant.
Correct, yeah. And there's all these other things that we could be picked up under. It's an interesting thing, too. There's been a meeting last Wednesday at the White House of chief of police from the major cities, particularly with the largest occupations, and to discuss classifying occupiers in some related way to being somehow associated with groups associated with terrorism of some nature. So they had a big planning meeting last Wednesday on that. And then the Department of Homeland Security has been having hearings, and there's been a bunch of proposals and some announcements about coordinating and strengthening intelligence operations in municipal and state and county law enforcement community, and having tighter communication through fusion centers with Homeland Security, FBI, and, of course, the military. And there's been some fear that police are actually perceiving themselves as being part of the 99% and less energetic about repressing some of the occupations, which there's feared will get much larger this spring. And so that meeting was an emergency meeting that the Obama administration had on Wednesday. And then, of course, the Federal Aviation Administration has granted licensing privileges for law enforcement in the United States to operate any types of drones. So far, the weapons on them are less than lethal, using electronic stun guns and things from air. But they're not apparently putting any Hellfire missiles or Gatling guns or anything like that on law enforcement drones or unmanned aerial vehicles as of yet. But you can qualify as a city for grants up to $300,000 to purchase these drones for your
do you
department.
Think that, Keith, do you think Food Not Bombs could get such a grant to use the drones, should we say, target illegitimate authorities that are attempting to deny people the right to serve free food?
That would be an interesting thing. So far, this is they are allowing farmers to use them to spray crops. So it is like expanding into civilian purposes. So there's a possibility that Food Not Bombs could. I think it's probably legal to use a drone and to use a drone armed with electronic stunning devices to bring down people like from ALEC and the American Legal, what's that called, Legislative Exchange, or any of these organizations like that, maybe Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute.
Well, maybe they could be used.
I think we're allowed to do that, but I'm not sure. They haven't made that clear yet.
Maybe you could attack them with carrots. I know carrot has been a symbol of, of the Food Not Bombs movement. A raised fist with a carrot in a circle is an old emblem of Food Not Bombs. We're talking with Food Not Bombs co-founder Keith McHenry, author of Hungry for Peace and a forthcoming slew of books. You're listening to Free Radio on 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. You may be able to call in and ask Keith a question. I'll keep an eye on the phone lines here at 469-3119, 469-3119. I wanted to read you, Keith, and get your reaction to the upcoming Occupy Oakland protest that's going to be happening on Saturday that some of us here in Santa Cruz are going to go to. It's a letter to the mayor about Saturday and Sunday, Move-In Day and Oakland Rise Up Festival. And I'm just going to read this one section. Talks about how the Mayor Kwan and the police force shut down Occupy Oakland twice, and how in response Occupy Oakland shut down the ports along with other groups. And it was also a response to, attempt to bust unions up in Washington and so forth. But there's this one phrase, I think, or this one paragraph interests me. Since the beginning of the Occupy movement, Occupy Oakland writes, when you have exacted, this is a letter to the mayor, violent repression on us, we have proven we are more powerful and diffuse than you. If you try to evict us again, we will make, and they're planning to occupy a building of some kind and turn it into a community center, we will make your lives more miserable than you make ours. This may be in one of more of the following forms: blockading the airport indefinitely, occupying City Hall indefinitely, shutting down the Oakland ports, calling on anonymous for solidarity. It will be in our mutual interest if you respect our occupation by recognizing our residency in eminent domain. We are sure that we all look forward to the needs of Oakland's people finally being met. Don't fuck with the Oakland commune. This sounds like terrorism to me that perhaps Obama can call in Homeland Security on. What do you think?
Well, I do think that that does sound exactly like what you're saying. Yeah, that's the type of terrorism he's been talking about. You know, and I've actually been in some meetings where people discussed blockading airports. There are certainly some dangers to that. I think that that might be
inappropriate provocation.
Yeah, it could be a problem for because then people have to, you know, what we realized in discussing that years ago was, and I forget why we were even discussing it, but it was that some strategic idea that we thought might be related to something that was happening, and we realized then that the publicity would be, oh wow, you know, people could die, you know, because their planes can't land and they run out of gas and stuff like that. So it was it seemed like it would be easy bait for the authorities to use that against us. But other things like shutting down, you know, occupying City Hall, so on, that's all reasonable. And I think we should work. I think actually the leadership of the Longshoremen's Union, if we met with them in a more concerted effort, we could actually get them. Now, I offered to get them to do a port shutdown up and down the coast, because the thing up in Washington State is really outrageous. They're trying to break the Longshoremen's Union with wheat shipments that they're bringing in, and they've opened up a port that is non-union, and it's the only non-union port on the Pacific coast. So that's something that, and then they've been accusing actually that local 21 of being like a terrorist organization. They accused them of attacking the sheriff's department, all these things that ended up proving to not be true. But they have been pretty militant, and they have tipped over shipments of wheat and so on. And so hopefully if we work, if we actually communicate more with the union, they can do a lot of, it's very powerful, because we have just-in-time manufacturing as still the process that's being used, and to shut down the ports for several days can cost the Koch brothers and these people billions of dollars. I think it was roughly $3 billion a day and lost the income to the large transnational corporations that rely on those ports. So I think that that is a wise strategy, and I certainly support the idea of occupying, you know, buildings, you know, homes not jails. There's been a lot of talk of homes not jails groups springing up again and joining in this whole occupying foreclosed housing. I was just reading a document yesterday where there is this is by Van Jones. I don't know how accurate this information is, but he was saying there is roughly 18 foreclosed homes for every homeless American. And that is really outrageous. And he was basically writing a document to protest the Obama's State of the Union address, which is pretty incredible. That's been not net, generally the you know, the focus of Van Jones. That was very heartening to see.
Yeah, Van Jones was, you know, he wanted to join the boys in Washington, and then he got kicked out, and I guess he may be a little resentful, huh?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he tried to actually work with the Democratic Party. This is what I think happened, potentially, when in reading that letter, although I have not talked to Van Jones, so I don't really know. Although, he was arrested with me on his first arrest, and
that was some time ago, right?
Yeah, that was on March 3rd of 93. And he was trying to, he was interviewed on CNN as saying that he was trying to work with the Democratic Party to get 2,000 occupiers elected to office. The occupiers really didn't go for that. There was a lot of blogs and essays saying they were not interested in doing that. And then, but also it could have been from the other side too. The Democratic Party was like, whoa, man, you know, we're not into that. Because a lot of people, for instance, pointed out Obama never mentioned the occupation at all. And also, obviously, we know that he's been organizing behind the scenes to try to drive the occupations out of sight. And I think that this is a very difficult issue, but excuse me, Keith,
what specifically do you have that Obama's done about trying to drive occupations out of sight?
Well, I mean, he had the Wednesday meeting to organize that with the heads of the chief of police of major departments around the country. That was an article that was published in a trade magazine about the Homeland Security issues. It's a pretty reliable trade magazine.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean he's trying to persuade them not to drive them out of sight, to be more tolerant and respect the First Amendment the way he does.
Yeah, well, that's not what the people that attended the meeting were claiming. They were claiming the opposite. And you have the Aspen Institute that just put out a white paper advocating there being also a situation where that's different. And, you know, excuse me, sir. I need to be a little quieter on here because I'm on the radio. Sorry. So I can
still hear you. You're talking about the Aspen Institute?
Yeah, the Aspen Institute. I mean, there's this whole Department of Homeland Security meetings and hearings before Congress and that have been happening. And the Aspen Institute's put out a paper urging tighter coordination between intelligence organizations and the Department of Homeland Security.
But what does this have to do with Obama, though? What is it? What's the you're claiming that Obama is a bad guy here who's anti-occupation? We know that he's, you know, a Democratic Party hack, and we know that he supports all this. You know, I mean, there's
well,
a Democratic Party politician.
It's very clear that he first of all, that he organized this meeting. And that was the focus of the meeting, and that Homeland Security has, that they have been having meetings at his, Napolitano, which is a cabinet person in the Obama administration, and Holder, who's a cabinet member in the Obama administration, as they're working on coordinated efforts to drive the occupation movements out of sight.
This is based on this one article about the
about this.
Okay, where can people get more information about this if they want to verify your wild claim?
Well, what they should do is email me, and I'll email. I have a whole group of links of about 20 links to.
And you can be emailed at
keith@foodnotbombs.net, or just go to foodnotbombs.net. .net. And at the bottom of every page, there's also menu@foodnotbombs.net.
Now,
but I've been collecting. I'm writing a book about this subject. I've been researching a lot, and I've been, there's like definitely crazy. There, one thing I'm having, I did get some data on this. I've been having trouble getting, there's a lot of websites about these subjects that are completely psychotic, right? And you have to be really careful about that. So it takes a lot of digging to get I can't always say InfoWars is accurate information or, you know, some of these things like that. But sometimes it gives you a hint about some sense of reality. So one of the ones that's been very difficult to verify, but I think I did find the Department of Homeland Security papers on it which is the issue of the massive purchasing of over $1 billion in meals ready to eat in the most recent federal budget, and that there's a company that manufactures meals ready to eat has actually cut off most of its customers because it's got this huge order from the Department of Homeland Security. So people are not clear why there's this emergency order of $1 billion worth of meals ready to eat, but they're, you know, I'm trying to, once I read that whole document, because it's a huge document, then I
hope to find some. Is this part of the concentration camps scare thing we're doing here?
Well, then there was another, yeah, I mean, actually, I'm trying to find out also, I got this KBR memo about the instant camps. But those camps, the issue with that one, it's not totally clear that could be a forgery. You know, that happens. The only thing that makes me suspicious that it's a potential forgery.
You know, let me interrupt you, Keith, because I want people to be able to research this issue, and you've given them the information to go to keith@foodnotbombs.net. I actually wanted to kind of pick up on your review of the last year. We got as far as Florida, Orlando, busts. I mentioned before you came on the air that essentially the Orlando Food Now Bombs won a victory of essentially being able to serve at City Hall, even though they didn't, I guess, what is it, Enola Park or whatever the heck the place they were originally serving at. They weren't able to get the mayor to back down on using other laws other than the thou shalt not feed laws to drive protesters away, which is what they're doing in Santa Cruz, by the way, with the Occupy movement. They've set up curfews, they're using lodging laws, they're using injunctions. They're not using such an obviously bizarre and unpopular law as thou shalt not feed poor people. Using very restrictive, you can only do it, you know, twice a year in these parks for groups of more than 24, which is what they were doing in Orlando. But can you continue with your chronology about what you think the most significant events of the year have been? And how much time we got left with you here?
I should probably go maybe in about 10 minutes or so.
Okay, well, if people want to call in, this is your big chance, folks. Give a call. Talk to Keith McHenry, 469-3119, if you got questions to ask Keith. And maybe I should just jump from this, review to my concern that I mentioned to you earlier on the phone, which is that Occupies look like they are fading out. And some of this, obviously, you know, mainstream would prefer to see it this way. Obama doesn't mention the word Occupy in his inaugural address, although if you look at the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle today, you see, you know, Occupy supposedly has provoked many themes, you know, yeah, themes indeed, you know, opportunities for the Democratic Party to glom onto and try to essentially siphon off the energy of the Occupy movement into their, you know, meaningless and actually destructive politicians. But you've been around the country a lot. You said, well, the Occupies are not disappearing. They're still there. They will sprout up like perhaps as Commander X or Christopher Doyen put it, like mushrooms with the spring rains or with the spring season. What leads you to think this? I mean, it's hard to find Occupies in big cities anymore. Monterey just shut down last Monday. Santa Cruz has been having, you know, very limited membership, and they've been meeting indoors, or they have been braving the curfew a little bit, but only for a brief period of time. Then people go home. Partially, it's because of the weather; they're cold. But you know, what have you seen?
Yeah, I do think the weather has been playing a role, and I do think though that we are, you know, one thing that we need to look face up to is a couple of different things. One, we need to come up with a clear strategy of retaking public space in those areas where we have not done so. A lot of the places have been forced out. And I think in a way that was good because there was the authorities. I mean, I know people think it's the other thing is true, but I really think the fact that we were forced out by force, by the authorities, instead of just only by the cold, was was really positive, because then it wasn't like us just petering out and giving up. But the other thing is that a lot of people are arguing that we shouldn't retake public space and be in public space, but I personally think that the strategy of being in public space, doing the occupations in the way it was for the first few months, is really important. But I think we also need to, and much more important than people are believing, I think that all the random actions, I mean, I've been going to, last night was a really wonderful action. There was Alec had a meeting for what the Alec version of, they have, our state assembly is meeting in New Mexico at the Roundhouse right now. We had a couple thousand people from Occupy show up on the opening day of the assembly. We disrupted the opening statement of the assembly. We stayed the entire day outside there, but the actual encampments, they've broken up. Of course, it's like below zero here, so it's like really life-threatening to live outside. But, and then last night was like, hundreds of people showed up to the protest at the El Dorado Hotel in Santa Fe to protest the wealthy people that were meeting to discuss legislation. And so all those are great things, and occupy our homes and occupy Congress. Occupy the courts. All these actions, I think, are really positive. And then there's some people suggesting doing that there be a group of principles that Occupy puts forward, and then if you don't sign this as a person running for elected office, then we'll publicly, make a big deal out of that's not a person that can be supported. And it's things like bring back Glass-Steagall, things like that. So there's a lot of energy in all those things, but I do think we need to get back out on the street because we over all the years I've been doing this, the most powerful things have been the actual physical occupations. But we also had all the tension around sabotage by the state in the latter half of the occupations and taking advantage of naturally occurring conflicts that would happen living under those situations. So I think that if we can review those ideas and reestablish our camps and maybe not do them in exactly the same place that we've been doing them, but also as the people in, this might be a wacky way to be doing it the way they were occupying this building in Oakland, but we have to, apply pressure on the politicians just the regards to not evicting us from the physical spaces. And I know that's really difficult, but somehow we need to come up with a strategy.
Well, I know Food Now Bombs kept coming back, and both in Orlando this last year, and of course, two decades ago when you and I were doing it in San Francisco, and you were doing it far more than I was, but, I did it too. And, over 1,000 people were arrested over a period of 7 years in San Francisco. And eventually, yeah. I think that, although Food Now Bombs became far less political in San Francisco, as far as I can see you never hear about it much anymore at all.
I'm writing about that because I've been doing calling people up and talking to them and writing.
What I'm saying is, though, that it had an impact that food serving has not been criminalized anymore in San Francisco, and although that may be because it's not being used as a political tool or weapon as much.
Right. I think they came up with a different strategy, which is partially what they've been doing with that's what this book I'm urgently trying to get out, or pamphlet, or whatever it will be. But because, I end up, because of dealing with Food Now Bombs chapters all over the world, and actually there's a really great article about Food Now Bombs' involvement in Occupy Russia that I just was checking out. It's really fascinating. Even PBS's NewsHour featured a Food Now Bombs kid in Russia who's now doing 15 more days. He just got out of jail after 15 days for being involved in the protest against the stolen election by Putin and so on. And Food Now Bombs did a series of actions in St. Petersburg in solidarity with Occupy in the United States. So there's a lot of this kind of coordination and stuff happening that we're not really seeing in the mainstream media.
What about this? Let's get back to this issue of what Food Now Bombs should do. Not Food Now Bombs, but Occupy, Food Now Bombs, any allied organizations, HUF, the group I work with, Homeless, United for Friendship and Freedom. As many times as you want, but the problem is that people have to be willing to face all kinds of criminal charges if they do, or at least they have to be, they deal with arrest, they lose the time from work, they get held in jail, their property gets seized and confiscated, and you and I know that's sort of a price that goes with the, you got, if you're going to stand up for an issue, you sort of take that in your stride and, you know, proceed. But a lot of people don't agree with that. By the way, in the studio with me is Linda LeMaster, who is currently facing criminal charges for lodging. That is actually a year and a half ago. She was doing the Peace Camp 2010 protest outside City Hall, which established an encampment for 3 months, actually a month at City Hall, and then, I'm sorry, at the courthouse, and then two more months at City Hall. Hey, Linda, say hello to Keith.
Hi. Hi, Keith.
Hey,
good to hear
Linda.
Your voice. How are you?
So cool. Good, good. I hope to be in town next month. That's so cool.
Oh, great, because I miss you out here.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking that when Robert talks about the San Francisco issue, which has been really a frustrating issue for me personally, of the Funa bombs there, I was trying to figure out some. I might get to spend some time in the Bay Area just to help out with that, because I think that's urgently needed.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a problem in the country with Funa bombs where there was a proposal that we'd be a charity. One of the activists in San Francisco food not bombs, and he got rid of the banner and the literature, and then we've never had banner and literature at the food not bombs meal in San Francisco since, and it's been really hard to get that to happen. And getting back to
Occupy, which is, you know, at this point broader than Food Not Bombs in a certain sense.
It seems to be significant,
or at least it has been over the last few months. You hear about it less and less in the mainstream media, though it does keep popping up in the Chronicle. I mean, Occupy Oakland, you know, was able to do two successive port shutdowns in October and November. I should say in November and December. You know, there's this occupation. It's kind of a spring reoccupation. We tried a reoccupation in Santa Cruz in December, and in, I think it was December 17th, along with a bunch of other folks. And, you know, they drove us. I wasn't out there. I was comfy at home in my little nest, but I also was covering it by, you know, waking up every hour, making notes on the computer, and put out a story about it. But, you know, they drove people away and discouraged people from doing that, and people have not been doing this. What kind of incentives, solutions, suggestions do you have to get folks out? And also, it looks like less. One of the arguments against militant action is not just that police are going to go after you, but that you will be discredited by being with people who are, quote, radicals, and you will then be, you know, you will not be listened to by the policymakers. It's the old reformists' argument that, you know, if you look too radical, then, you know, the mayor won't listen to you anymore, and all your labor allies will go away because you're far too militant.
Yeah, well, I think that, I mean, there's all kinds of sabotage, you know, efforts like that to keep this from happening. But my feeling is that we, you know, this is just like a sample scenario that we had discussed back in, I think it was 2005, when we were talking about organizing occupation of the White House. And coming out with, like, cardboard signs of tents and so on, not real tents, within signs that have our statements and stuff, and going to a space where, you know, finding a public space where to just be, that maybe is not like right exactly where the cops have already been attacking us, but some other still good public high visibility location. Set up an information table or have information on, you know, when we started at McPherson Park in Occupy DC, we just set out cloths on the ground because they were harassing us about literature tables. And we just slowly kept building up different, you know, it looked more like street theater at first than it was, and so on. And even though we're infiltrated, people will know the strategy from the state, still to organize in a manner where it's sort of a, it's mostly just a First Amendment thing, that it's not really an occupation, even though you're, you know, like there all the time. There's been these loopholes people have searched for. At the same time, for instance, in Tucson, they're able to, you know, the occupation is actually the same physical space, but it's not in the park. It's on the sidewalk surrounding the park. So it's there 24/7, and there's been a bunch of occupations done like that. Yeah, but I do think we need a permanent presence, even if it's not appeared to be an occupation in the way it was in the first 2 months. But to start to do something of that nature, even if it's just literature tables and it's food showing up three times a day and things like that, until and my feeling is there's going to be some crazy economic calamity, some really stupid things that are become part of the news about the election, or some kind of thing that is going to, we're going to find out that the government has actually, you know, stolen even more money than we normally are hearing about. Some kind of crazy things are going to happen, which will motivate more people to want to participate. So if we stay nonviolent, but we also have a place for the public to find us, I think so much of mainstream America is completely upset about what's going on in the economy, and they're less and less buying the logic that, that basically Obama's going to save.
Well, let me be devil's advocate here. Actually, Linda, you may have something you want to say. Do you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I'll just put one sentence out. I think that when they try to use these petty crimes to keep hungry people from eating, why not turn around and bring out our analysis of how insurance companies have stomped out public spaces and tied the hands of government that's supposed to be for the people behind their backs, and expose these things that we don't usually think of when the knuckles are meeting each other in public?
I think we should. The confiscation of public space by private corporations is really an urgently needed. We need to come up with literature about these ideas, flyers and pamphlets, and really, and maybe have a national day of action around that specific issue that you're talking about and other related issues. And one of the big things about this, the whatever it's called, the State of the Union, that was interesting was that it was completely unexciting, and we're in a crisis of such major proportions, and to have like the supposedly glorious president come out and say basically a bunch of lame things that are not really totally, you know, half measures and under this situation is really crazy, and I think we could rebuild the momentum.
Let me talk more about.
Think outside the box.
Keith, let me ask you more about the strategy, because I'm going to be let me be the devil's advocate here. The three major reasons that have been used to suggest that people should not return outside is, one, that this involves a large homeless issue that gets interjected into it and becomes a major energy drain, a major preoccupation, a major put off for middle class people who are frightened or repelled by this issue, or just the idea that, you know, yes, the homeless are an issue, they're a part of this, but they're only one part of it. The other parts have to do with the banks, the foreclosures, the insurance companies that Linda was speaking about, corruption in the Congress, stuff that is not being organized around, because all the energy is being put into, you know, dealing with the perception of people that this is just a big homeless encampment, the perception of people that, you know, the idea that you have to put a lot of energy into a 24-hour occupation. So instead of doing the research and getting things done or doing marches down to banks, you're spending all your time organizing people to come at 2 in the morning to freeze their asses off, and then they get busted or they get ticketed or harassed by the police, and more energy is spent. What do you say to people who would tell you that?
Okay, well, two different basic things. One, on the issue of the homelessness, I think that that is something that we have to address, and I think that what would be important is to basically organize a committee of the people that are living on the streets, and this is in rougher situations than maybe Santa Cruz, because Santa Cruz is a smaller place, so everybody kind of knows each other, but in Oakland, San Francisco, and New York City and stuff, and to specifically organize a trip where the potentially it's a homeless encampment protest for the rights of homeless that is not necessarily, maybe it's on one half of the occupation and one part of the occupation, and we've been struggling with that in a bunch of cities. You know, this is a pretty common problem. And an aspect of this too is to set up some simple guidelines about that if you're like acting up and causing problems, you're not to be there.
Wait a minute. How do you enforce? What are you going to be your own police force? Bring in the peace monitors? Suddenly start?
Well, it's a difficult thing. That's why it might be better to people, we have to figure out, if we're going to make actually transform society. We're going to have to figure out how to deal with this specific issue. So I think that it's even, no matter, you know, I think it's so important, to me, it's so important to be on the streets on an ongoing basis, because the energy of that is actually the, you know, we would not be talking about the occupations, the media wouldn't be talking about the occupations, the media wouldn't, for years we've been talking about the same issues, organizing the same, like, marches and protests and everything, and it wasn't until we were out on the streets for 2 months and an occupation that we were able to actually, you know, even be on the radar. I mean, you know that. We've been out there for like 35 years, and no one paying any attention
well,
for the first 35
but,
years.
But now but, that tactic has been used, and the police and the authorities have responded by saying, we're going to use massive police bullshit, phony laws, park closing laws, curfews, injunctions, you name it, to get rid of you. And now it's not just people get to show up on the streets and the police are nervous about driving people away. They're not nervous anymore. They're doing it regularly and systematically. So what do you think?
I think we still have to, I mean, that's the thing, is we're going to succeed. We're going to have to expect that. And I think a lot of people, as the economy continues to crash and get more desperate, I mean, a lot of the people I met that were homeless in many of these in occupations on the East Coast were only recently homeless, right? They were only homeless for the basically 2 months, 3 months before this thing happened, and they showed up. And they were completely, so it was like the dynamic of, you know, it was just like after the earthquake in San Francisco in 89, where you had the, you know, the current, the newly homeless. And
I mean, nobody doubts that's true. Nobody doubts that, and I saw it here in Santa Cruz. I mean, people came out of jail, which is right across the street from our occupation. They walked over, they got a tent, they got a place to stay, they joined the occupation. If some of them moved on, some of them stayed. We're talking about jail for petty crimes. There was no major crime in the encampment, unless you want to talk about use of illegal drugs, which of course was a big thing, or the fact that people had to go take a dump somewhere and they locked the bathrooms at night, so finally we set up our own porta potties. So it's
right.
true that that's the case,
do,
but
need,
wait a minute, the point
we
is...
We need to organize that
the
again.
Point is, well, I mean, you can't. It doesn't. No. I mean, you got organized because it was tolerated and grew. It will not be tolerated again. That's the point. How do you organize in a situation where the police will immediately slap down what's going on? That's the question I have.
That's what I'm saying is, you go out there with we have to just go out there we have to figure out the exact physical space that's best to do this in the public, and go out there with representations of images of an occupation, and we have to come up with a plan strategy of where we're going to go, where we're going to stay, what we're going to do, and have it already pre-thought out, so that by the time we're doing it, you know, we've got a number of strategies and options of locations, and to maybe we're easing into it, like you have like a smaller number of people, and to grow over time, things like that. We just have to really think creatively and figure out how to do this, because I think that that's going to be super important. And I think that over time, I mean, it may be that a lot of people get arrested, and it keeps being that. And we've done that before, right? Like you said, in San Francisco. But I think it's so crucial that we have a place that's in the public square that everyone can find at any time of night, day, to participate and join in.
Well, the only new idea that I hear here, which is, and it's not a bad one, is that we find a particular place, which is becoming harder and harder in Santa Cruz. Every area, and most areas in town, are now controlled by administrative edict of the Parks and Rec Department. They can lock down any area by simply putting up signs that say closed after a certain time. Curfew, curfew, curfew. And so they in essence, they can enact a kind of martial law in whatever zone they want. I guess the only difference is public sidewalks, but in public sidewalks, and I'm talking about Santa Cruz here because I'm talking to a Santa Cruz audience, and I know you know...
Yeah, well, I think that's what they did in Tucson. We started in Tucson. We have about 20, 30 people in Tucson sleeping on the sidewalk around where the former occupation was, but with all the same signs that we had at the actual occupation. And so in the middle of the day, we're in the park, you know, and then as soon as it's curfew, we just moved to the sidewalk.
Well, we tried that. We tried that 2 years ago with Peace Camp 2010. Admittedly, a much smaller and much poorer class of people. And, you know, and that's where, Linda, you got, you know, you got busted on the steps of the courthouse.
Right.
But you were also a participant, an illegal sleeper around the county, I mean, around the city hall as well. We moved to the sidewalk. Then they made it illegal to be on the sidewalk, blocking the sidewalk.
Yeah, that was quite a funny show worthy of you and Keith. Every time, like every other day, they come up with a new thing that's illegal. Like for at least as long as I've been here, over 40 years, you can smoke on the outside benches. Is facing the street from the library, suddenly, and they got big built-in stone ashtrays for you, too. Suddenly, that's illegal. Suddenly, touching the window glass is illegal at the library, which is across the street from City Hall. Suddenly, the campus is off-limits at 7 p.m. or something, unless they happen to be having a meeting, and then you get a 15-minute escape time. You got to be gone after city meetings. Just every day, another thing.
Maybe the thing is to write up information about these craziness of these laws. Another thing is to have like a public meeting where it's discussed in a indoor space at the Veterans Hall or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then also at that public meeting, though, advertise it to neighboring communities to try to encourage people from San Francisco and, to have more of a reciprocal, cooperation. That's what we've been doing in New Mexico, is what we all go from one town to another in solidarity with that town's action, so that there's like three times as many people at that small town's action, because we're not just depending on the local people of that actual town.
Right.
And, well, I know we did that,
also,
Keith. We did that back
to try to embarrass them into, because the thing is that the economy is crashing. You have half the people like living out are struggling to survive. We're going to have like huge more economic crisis, which is going to drive larger waves of Americans into total poverty than we already have now.
Well, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, that's what my father always used to say. Well, the Depression is coming. But, we've been waiting around for, three decades, four decades, five decades?
Robert,
this,
you don't
this,
agree with him? You can't see things deteriorating?
Hang on a second. The so-called Depression. But, I mean, I think these are all good ideas. I should mention in Santa Cruz, the benches that Linda talked about at the library are now gone. They've been removed, by the way. So there are no benches there. It's illegal to, even if they were there, it would be illegal to be in those benches at night. But I think, I'm not saying this can't be done. I'm saying that it's... it does, as you say, require not just a lot of good organizing. It requires committed people who are willing to do this. I guess you're saying that, I suppose a small band of really dedicated people, and that's what Peace Camp 2010 was after a while, a very small band.
And now
they got crushed.
I guess
you've got to get crushed again and again until finally you don't get crushed, right?
Some guy dies in the dumpster, and then people over town are talking about it.
Yeah, and you
Some
have
guy
that.
Has
look,
died
you
in
were
the
doing that. You were doing that in 2010, so and then in 2011, suddenly that's happening all over the world. So
well,
that's
yeah,
the
but
other
that,
thing that we
that came,
know,
I think that happened. Go ahead, Keith.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I think that we were doing all these little occupations and these like little things, and we don't take. We don't realize that it's all added up to this one giant thing, and that all these different little actions we've done for the last 35 years are. Finally starting to happen. And then we don't want people to die or to be killed, but look at the people in other countries, what they're doing, to stand up to this same kind of stuff.
I wonder if there is really any relation between what we've done in the past and what's happening now. It's nice to imagine that's true. I don't really see that kind of direct connection. I mean, I think a lot of the occupation stuff, I don't know where it came from. I mean, obviously Tunisia, and in Egypt had a big impact, and the determination of Occupy Wall Street had an impact, but I don't know that you and I and Food Not Bombs and Huff and others and Linda's group Bag Ladies Revolt and Housing Now in Santa Cruz, those are two groups you work with, Linda,
and
actually
Hungry Women United
actually prompted this. It's nice to imagine that's true.
I think it's true,
but it turns out to be true. I mean. This is what I know, anyway, is in writing this book, I talked to all these people that have turned out to be friends of mine about the General Assemblies in Manhattan before Occupy Wall Street. And it turned out that a huge percentage of those, a lot of those people were actually either Funabom's kids or people from other groups that Funabom has been working with for years. And that was, it turned out, one of my, you know, things I was trying to find out is why did Consensus and Mic Check and all that be part of Occupy Wall Street? Well, it turned out the media, General Assemblies were, since they were original ones, were organized by people, including Food Not Bombs, they were naturally using those decision-making processes because all that coalition of kids in New York were already using that process.
It's not true in Santa Cruz, though. It's not true in Santa Cruz. We had a whole new group. We had a whole new group of people, which was good, not bad that there's a whole new group of people. But I don't think it drew old activists into it very much. A little bit.
I do. All the papers were saying that at the beginning. Some of the people that were homeless people pointed out all the old, tired, liberal, progressive hacks that showed up at the first meeting. And there were a lot of people that continued, like Peter Klotz Chamberlain. Like you,
there were a few people.
Let me finish. I'm trying to say because people that have been around the block more than once were there. More of the young people that were there to see what it was about stayed. I believe that.
I don't know. I don't know.
And in Occupy Wall Street, it turned out that there was a lot of people showed up on the 17th at Wall Street that had no connection to any progressive or any type of movement at all.
I'm going to butt in, Keith. We're talking with Keith McHenry here, Food Not Bombs co-founder, author of Hungry for Peace, and a guy who's already talked 25 minutes past his 10-minute time.
Oh, that better go.
To leave that. Now, not that I'm complaining a lot, but I do have other stuff I should probably do.
Yeah, I should go. I really got to go, too. But anyway, I just think that in closing, go to funabombs.net. And also, I'm really optimistic.
You're always optimistic, Keith. Come on.
I know. And
when have you not been optimistic?
All these things. You're not going to end capitalism if you're not optimistic about trying to end capitalism. Anyway, have a good night.
Keith, thank you very much.
We can make something better for people to live in.
Thanks, Keith. And it's Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Call-in lines are, just as they were, open, 427-3772, 469-3119. Again, 427-3772, 469-3119. And again, a couple of things that are coming up immediately. And since there's only about 25 minutes left in the show, maybe 20 minutes, because Uncle Dennis usually tends to be fluffing around in the studio, blundering here and there, making it difficult for those of us who are trying to finish our show. He's actually not here yet.
Fluffing around?
Well, fluffing isn't the right word. Let's say, I don't know, whatting around, something around. Anyway, there's a couple things coming up. There's a protest plan tomorrow, or it's really kind of more of an informational tabling, which some of us from HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, are going to be doing. We've talked about doing this for a while outside the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which they call the Homeless Services Center, the HSC. That's out there right at Highway 1 and Highway 9, that intersection. It's actually at 115 Cole Street, about a block from there, for those of you who are interested in being a part of this. We're going to set up a... If we're able to do this, we tried to do a protest at City Hall on Tuesday, and that one... I have to say it fizzled. I mean, hey, why not be honest about it? I mean, probably a lot of good reasons not to be honest about it. But nonetheless, that's what happened. We're trying to get information about what's happening out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. A lot of complaints have come out over the last 6 months about abusive behavior in terms of over-control, about people not being able to get documentation that the shelter was full on nights that they got tickets.
And cutbacks in services.
Cutbacks in services, as Linda says. Becky Johnson has documented a bit of this in her own writing. You go to BeckyJohnsonOneWomanTalking.blogspot.com. Although I don't know if she's actually, that article is there. She also puts out documentation on the HUF email, which you can get, by the way, if you want to be a part of the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom email, if that's a subject that interests you. You can give a call to 423-HUF, 423-4833. Leave me a message, or you can send me an email at rnorse, that's me, Robert Norse, rnorse3@hotmail.com, and I'll put you up onto the HUF email list. But what Becky was writing about was the fact that You now have to pay for mailroom privileges. I guess they are allowing... They were talking about eliminating one of the two meals a day. That hasn't been done. But lockers, I think, are still either severely cut back or just absent out there at the Homeless Lack of Services Center. The excuse I heard when I was at one of their community meetings 6 months ago was they needed more office space for the staff, which I think the tone of my voice tends to convey my opinion of that. They are also, we have, you know, I have a particular problem with... the attractive, well-spoken, and fair Monica Martinez, who's the executive director of the Homeless Service Center, seems to be sort of the Zach Friend of the homeless community. Zach Friend is, of course, a police PR guy who is now running for and has been endorsed by the former Board of Supervisors member Ellen Peary. He's a Democratic Party hack and a police department fluffer and whitewasher, who has made numerous false statements over the years regarding the police department's activities. I mean, it's his job is to, you know, make the police department appear in a positive light. But insofar as it impacts homeless people and how they treat homeless people, it pisses me off, and I attempt to raise issues. So we're going to be out there tomorrow at 2:30, for those of you who are interested. We'll be serving coffee. We'll be taking reports of people who lost their property thanks to the Parks and Rec Department's Rangers seizures of property, or the mass seizures that happened on December 8th when 100 to 200 homeless people were forcibly evicted with no legal place to go from the homeless campground next to Occupy Santa Cruz and San Lorenzo Park. Their tents compacted and destroyed, their property destroyed. Although it was claimed by Police Chief Vogel when we marched to the Parks and Rec Department, and he and his squads of police were defending it from the threat that we had, or he had heard we had, we didn't have it with us, but there was a threat to set up a tent in front of City Hall, which apparently he felt was a major threat that required a major amount of police. I believe there were several, there was at least a dozen cops there more earlier. When I was there, there were seven or eight. They harassed and surrounded a photographer, Alex DeRosi. I was threatened personally
when
by the
this?
Chief of Police December 8th, the day of the destruction of the homeless campground.
There were 80 or more cops.
I'm talking about at City Hall.
At City Hall.
Oh, okay.
There were over 100 over there in the benchlands in the courthouse.
You were at City Hall, huh?
I was at City Hall an hour waiting for you guys to march over.
And we were a little
so
late.
So were a few other people, including Mitch and a few guys I don't know, but from Occupy. And so I walked around and counted heads.
Well, were they training on the green with their weapons?
They
what were they
waiting,
doing?
But they were in full riot gear with their little truncheons and their face masks. And then finally, about 20, 22 minutes into, after the, what was it, at noon or after 1, whichever it was supposed to be at, the chief told them they can sit down. And some of them did. And within another 15 minutes, I didn't hear this part, but some of them went away, so there were fewer by the time you got there. But I counted 80 people there at the time that, even though Parks and Rec's door was closed and nobody was there.
And the city offices
were
also closed.
Yeah.
City offices were locked. I tried to get into the city offices as well. They were closed, and it was, you know, during the open hours of the city offices. It was a complete abrogation of the rights of the public to have access to the public property, access to their public officials, and the people employed by the public officials. We were trying to talk to Danette Shoemaker or her representative. She was out of town, I believe, but her representative at Parks and Rec was certainly there. And Parks and Rec wasn't really closed. It was just closed to us. We saw people going in and out through locked doors that we were not allowed into.
Huh.
The implication being that you are such a threat, we're not going to let you into these buildings, even though we had no weapons. Or as Michael Tomasi used to say, the guy who died recently and was heralded as a great hero and a wonderful fellow and a great guy. The vet, a little kind of a feisty little vet who, you know, liked to spend his time, you know, alternately praising and denouncing the city council. Essentially, I mean, I really had mixed feelings about Michael Tomasi. And
well, he had mixed feelings, but he had them strongly and passionately.
Yes, he did, but he was used by the city council as their excuse for shutting down oral communications, at the same time showing how caring they were about the homeless because, see, they let this guy give the same speech every time. They actually had no choice about how he was the king of marijuana and he had been the so-and-so battalion in Vietnam and so forth. And he saluted them, and he was going to, the head of the internal security of heaven was going to bitch slap them if they didn't shape up.
I remember.
And it always was kind of an amusing little aside. And he also had important things to say that got sort of lost because he went through this rap that made him look like some kind of lunatic. He talked about how his dog had been killed. The police had confiscated his van. He had noticed people outside being harassed and around, you know, inappropriate enforcement of the marijuana laws and other things. He was, you know, he had things to say. Unfortunately, he was mostly sort of the class clown. But in any case, this protest, which is happening tomorrow, and it's really, as I said, informational tabling and some coffee. We're going to invite people to come and talk about the property they've lost and actually fill out claims for the property they've lost so that we can, you know, present them to the police department, present them to the city hall and the city council, and then if we have adequate legal assistance or maybe not, just taking it to small claims court, hold the city accountable for its destruction of the campground. Now, we're also going to be suggesting to people hearing what they want to do next, although the homeless service center or lack of services center is usually not the best place to find militant people. Here you find people who are kind of co-opted, who are kind of beaten down, who are kind of desperate, who are...
Or at least circumspect when they're on campus.
And circumspect. They don't want to be sort of... Campus is a nice phrase indicating it's, you know, it's like some sort of friendly college unit place. It's actually a rather heavily policed area that most homeless people don't have access to most of the time. Whereas the bureaucrats who run the place, you know, come in and out and do what they want. It's homeless people are not allowed on that property except for limited purposes, for the meals, to line up for the armory bus, or if they get on the waiting list, two to six week wait for getting into the Paul Lee loft, you know, or possibly to do their laundry. You know, there are very limited reasons. And if you want to pay for your mail, you can get your mail, you know. So it's, you know, I'm curious to hear and see what how people are feeling out there. I'm also going to be there trying to get some accounts for free radio and see what's going on. Linda?
This what I call the campus, because it's a number of different programs and even different buildings, is at Coral Street right off of Highway 9.
It's at 115 Coral Street at the intersection of Highway 9 and Highway 1. And we're going to be probably... We will attempt to set up a table inside at the Homeless Service Center property if they're giving us trouble. If it were up to me, I'd probably say, good, call the police, and we'll deal with that issue when it comes up in court. But because I think they're open to the public, and therefore you can't deny people First Amendment rights there. But, you know, because we're dealing with people who have become more timid over the years on these issues, or some of whom just don't want to deal, or more tired, you know. They don't want to deal with the police and the courts, although you have to be willing to, unfortunately, to some extent, if you're going to, you know, not be driven away or frightened away. I'm not saying you can't do a little guerrilla action where you come and, you know, you where the pressure comes and you go somewhere else and you pop up where they're not squeezing the balloon, so to speak. But we'll be on the sidewalk probably, too. And if people are interested, come on down, 2:30. It's at 115 Coral Street. If you want more information, give a call to 423-HUFF. Then the next day, there is this Occupy Oakland event that's happening. I'm probably going to be going up there to Occupy Oakland. It is an attempt to redo, should we say, reoccupy. They don't use the word reoccupy this time. It is, let's see what they say about it here. They say, help Occupy Oakland get settled into its new home on January 28th. Like millions of people in this country, Occupy Oakland has no home. On January 28th, move-in day, we're going to change that. We're going to occupy a large vacant building and convert it into a social center. Come join us for the initial occupation. There will be a festival all that weekend to celebrate our new home. Why are we doing this? Occupy Oakland is about people providing for themselves and others, since it is clear that the system can no longer provide for them. It is a place where people who are fed up can come together and develop new forms of struggle. In other words, it's like the Occupies that happened throughout the country in October and November and December before they were crushed or shut down or driven away or went into hibernation, if you hope, we hope. Here in Santa Cruz and elsewhere. Since November, the city of Oakland and its police force have made it impossible for us to meet, to serve food, and to provide a place for people to stay in our original home at Oscar Grant Plaza. also known as Frank Ogawa Plaza, for those who are more traditional. At the same time, all over the city, thousands of buildings sit empty for the simple reason that they exist to enrich the 1% rather than meet people's needs for space and shelter. Occupy Oakland has a demonstrated need for such a space. We have served tens of thousands of media of meals without charge, provided a place for thousands of people to sleep free from police repression, planned and carried out actions in which tens of thousands of people have participated. More importantly, unlike a charity, Occupy Oakland provides people with the opportunity to get involved and determine the direction of the movement. It is open to the initiative of everyone. How will the occupation work? Full shape of the activities that happen in the building is yet to be determined. We need you to come to help us do that. For now, there are plans for a kitchen, sleeping quarters, meeting space for committees, working groups, space for kids, a library, and a media room. Possibilities are endless. We have learned from the experience at Oscar Grant Plaza that we can do much more to make this space safe for everyone, especially women and queer people. We will continue to develop our capacity to take care of each other, how about homeless people, folks, and keep each other safe without involving the police. The Occupy movement is, they're not saying how, but they're saying they've learned, and it's kind of vague, isn't it? The Occupy movement is largely based on direct action outside the law. And I want to point out, there's more about this. Like with the encampment of Oscar Grant Plaza, the building move-in is not legal. As with the plaza, however, there is safety in numbers. That is, the more of us there are, the less chance there is of a police attack. We believe that the best way to protect each other is to set up a free open space in which people can come and go. We hope that eventually our presence in the building will become normalized and we can keep it long-term. To that end, we intend to have a large festival during the move-in weekend, which will invite people from all over the city to come and celebrate the new space with us. During those 2 days, we will hold assemblies to further define and organize the use of the building. Does this sound familiar, folks?
This does to me.
Sounds like November 30th here in Santa Cruz, when 75 River Street was occupied, the vacant property, the former bank, was kind of being, you know, leased out by Wells Fargo to other folks, and nothing was being done there.
Sounds a little more together about the determination than what I saw.
Some criticisms of that occupation have to do with the fact that people did not actually create the community center. They talked about they should have immediately moved in whatever they needed to do, created it, and then if the police tore it down, as we knew they would, then that would be on the police, and it would show that they are more interested in defending the 1%, as they are, than they are in enriching the community space or dealing with those issues that, you know, the city can't deal with and won't deal with and prefers to, you know, let people crap in the bushes and die on the and die outside for.
The whole government cannot support the safety net it created, and we need one about five times the size of the one that this country had created in our names.
Occupy created its own safety net, and this building takeover in November, which was not done by Occupy officially. This is constantly ranted and raged by Occupy Santa Cruz conservatives. There are the conservatives in Occupy Santa Cruz who don't like the idea of it. You know, of it happening, who felt that it... some of them have legitimate concerns about it, but...
So why do you call them conservatives? What does that mean here?
Well, it means, I think it's a mixed group of people who had criticisms of the 75 River Street action, but it's used... I call them conservatives because they've picked up on the police department's propaganda around this and the city authorities' propaganda that this was somehow an evil and lawless and vandalistic activity that, you know, to besmirch the whole movement. When in fact, it was an attempt to move the whole movement forward by an autonomous group that was in the spirit of the movement, for sure. And it was said, oh, this resulted in the crackdown on the campground. No, the campground was under an injunction already. And Danette Shoemaker had already attempted to preempt the injunction, which Occupy Santa Cruz attorney Ed Fry had gotten into federal court so that it had to be delayed while free speech issues could be discussed. So they didn't want to wait for that. They created a phony emergency. They didn't even create an emergency. They falsely claimed there was an emergency and declared an evacuation, which was a complete nonsense. And in other words, 75 River Street had really little to do with the destruction of the campground, other than it did provide an excuse because so many people bought this bullshit. And so many people, hang on a second, are so legalistic in their approach. They somehow believe that defending a bank's property is the same as defending your house or your sleeping bag, which is completely ridiculous, in my view.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's obscene to leave these buildings empty while the people that are dying in the streets have to walk past them to get from one little morsel to another. But what is your position about the criticism that I hear amongst the people on the different polls within Occupy here that one of the missteps of those who led the, well, took the lead in taking over the bank, the empty bank building, was they weren't forthright. They didn't really tell all their marchers they were going to end up in a bank building downtown. I was led to believe it was a foreclosed house in some residential place.
I was in that march, and I wasn't sure where it went, frankly. And frankly, it wasn't that important to me. But yes, I've heard that criticism, and I think that people, you know, who had that criticism have an apt criticism. I think that that's appropriate. In fact, the guy who runs as a monitor on the Occupy Santa Cruz Facebook page has been very passionate about that. And unfortunately, he and others have used their concern about the sort of disingenuous manipulation by leaders of autonomous groups to lure innocent, you know, occupiers into an illegal situation. You know, I think anybody who, when they got to the bank, nobody had to go in. They didn't have to if they wanted. It was obvious it wasn't a house. So, you know, the fact that I don't know.
So you feel that criticism is a small thing, considering what else
was
involved.
It was a small thing. I mean, I think it's a legitimate concern, perhaps. I mean, I don't know how much misrepresentation there was. Maybe you can give me more details, although we only have 6 minutes left in the show.
No,
I also want to say that we have another action happening. Well, there's no action happening, but there is an event happening. The McPherson Center will be hosting the Nexties Awards on Saturday. And the Nexties Awards are this group, I think it is, in spite of the Santa Cruz Weekly's attempt to distinguish it from Next Space, it is connected, I believe, with Next Space.
Oh, yeah, the Next Space. The people that established Next Space created the Next Space.
And the Next Space is a Coonerty Jeremy Nooner production. Ryan Coonerty is a right-wing council member masquerading as a constitutional lawyer and a progressive who was mayor, one of the worst mayors, in my view. Although Lane, you know, I'll give him a run for his money with all his homeless babble while he continues to do the same policies. Anyway, Next Space is having Nexties Awards. I want to find out exactly when that is, because Huff at the meeting it had on Wednesday talked about actually doing a protest there, and we didn't get to it because it's happening the same day as Occupy Oakland is happening, and some of us want to go to that. And I don't know if I actually can get to it. Let me see if I can.
Get to the Nexties or the Occupy Oakland?
Well, you already talked about the... I'm going to say when this... For those who do want to attend this and protest it, or... This is where Monica Martinez will be showing up. She was featured in last week's Santa Cruz Weekly as one of, you know, the heroes of the Nexties. She's, you know, the oncoming homeless caring service provider. And I've mentioned before, she's a liar. I mean, it's really as simple as that. And it's hard to get beyond that for me. I had a long time where I thought she was just being obstructive, being a bureaucrat, trying to cover her ass. But she, when I confronted her publicly 6 months ago on community TV, and you can go back and actually see this online, and said, you know, are you going to, will you change the policy that will not allow, you don't allow your underlings to write letters to homeless people who come in, and they've been busted by police on nights when the shelter was full, and previously shelter would write a letter saying it's full. Now you won't do that, and you're insisting they sign up for a waiting list so they be a part of your, I don't know, grant proposals in the future. They have to be a part of your racket, your scheme, your whole approach, in order to get a simple statement of what actually was true, that the shelter was full on that night. And her response was, oh, we do that all the time, and we've always done that, and of course we'll do that. But they don't do that, because when I called 2 weeks ago, and other times, I got reports from at least two other people going in asking for such a letter. They're told, we do not do that. Most recently, Monday night, I got that information from a woman with a child who attempted to get a ticket signed off, a letter written to the court saying the shelter was full. They wouldn't do that. And also, we've asked Martinez to just issue a statement that the shelter is usually full throughout the summer. She won't do that either. We asked her to state you know, to give a piece of paper to people who are on the waiting list so they can show it to the police saying, see, I'm on the waiting list. The law says if I'm on the waiting list, my ticket's going to be dismissed, so don't ticket me. She won't do that either. More important, she lies and says they are doing that. So, as far as I'm concerned...
Robert, I don't have the same antipathy you have toward her, but I felt that she was dishonest in the court where Ed Fry was the attorney for the homeless people who... The other people that got lodging tickets besides me and, well, a couple of people, that she was trying to make it sound like late at night there are open shelter beds there at that campus I mentioned earlier at Homeless Services Center if you try hard enough to get them. And there aren't really. And it was really a walnut shell game to put it out like that. And the judge and the jury bought it. There was no way to correct what had been misstated there. So, you know, I kind of agree with you point by point sometimes, but I think they're lucky to have her as an administrator.
Why?
Even though she's not responding yet to the things that come to you from the actual homeless people. I think she's a good administrator.
She's not responding. She's lying about it. She's misrepresenting the thing to the public. She is disburdening homeless people, not just by her actions, but trying to cover her ass by creating a pretty picture of what's going on. She is, as I said, the Zach Friend of the Homeless Services Center. This event that's going to be happening that I'm mentioning, the Nexties Awards, are happening on Saturday night.
Saturday night.
And they are going to be happening at the McPherson Center, which is, I guess, at Front and Cooper Streets. And it's going to be a party, scrumptious foods from top local restaurants. This is the kind of the group that she's really catering to. It has nothing to do with the homeless. It has to do with political aspirations for essentially, you know, an upscale yuppie crowd. It's January 23rd, 7 p.m. And I beg your pardon, it is not at the McPherson Center. It is at 2801 Mission Street, the former Wrigley building. I'm not quite sure where that is. Do you know where that is?
Yeah. If you go on the local Mission Street, not out the highway Mission Street going north, you got to duck in behind the 7-Eleven, and there's a parallel road to Mission Street. And Wrigley's is there. There's a light where you can turn left there. You'll see Wrigley's.
And if I were around and people wanted to deal with it, I would do a protest around this as well. The people who are supporting it are... the Santa Cruz Seaside Company, the Owl Family Properties, Good Times, Surf City Vintners, Nielsen Architects and Design Studio. I'm looking at a few. Santa Cruz Metal Polishing, Community Television of Santa Cruz County. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, they'll probably be working.
You know, this is yuppieism, and it pisses me off because it's like it's honoring someone who is an abuser of homeless people rather than someone who is an assister of homeless people. Huh. Anyway, that's my view on this. I know it sounds like we disagree on this one, Linda. And
I think you're harsh. I think she's catering to these people to get them to give money to homeless people through their programs and not catering to them because she'd rather be there than at work. I'm not commenting on your other list of critiques.
Well, you know, whatever the motivation, if you know, you need to be candid about what you're doing. And if you're going to be doing it, you have to be honest about it. If you're not being honest about it, as far as I'm concerned, as you were saying, with respect to people leading people down to protests, where they say they're going one place and they end up going another.
Absolutely.
It is bullshit. And
Hi, Uncle Dennis.
Uncle Dennis has joined us in the studio. He's examining some of my new bumper
stickers. That one and another one.
I actually have a few of those for sale, which I'm going to give to Free Radio to make money with. Free Radio is in need of money, is it not, Uncle Dennis?
Especially from you, Robert, being 3 months...
Oh my gosh!
We aren't going to talk about this on the air, are we?
I told you the safety net isn't working.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Robert,
free radio. Send money.
I put a check there a week ago. I don't know what you've not been looking at the.
I haven't looked at it last week.
Oh, there you go. So actually,
if you put it there on Sunday. I haven't been in the studio since.
Yeah, I don't remember, but probably was Sunday or maybe it was last Thursday. I don't remember. But you know, let's not discuss my financial contributions to the station on the air because. Well, we can if we wish, but it sounds rather tedious, boring, and not really relevant to our topic.
Have to be candid, like those activists we were talking about.
So I'll be back. There is going to be this action happening tomorrow at 2:30. If you want to come out, you get some free coffee.
Yeah,
Becky's
going to
be bringing free coffee at Cafe Huff, as we call it, outside the Santa Cruz lack of homeless services center.
Right there.
And open the box and see. I'm getting harassed. Didn't I tell you I was going to get harassed by Uncle Dennis?
Especially since it's 8:03.
I know. He's arrived a little late, so he's doing his harassment a little bit late. But this is the standard practice. I'm not making any complaints. I'm just
free radio policies and guidelines.
Here we go.
You should be ready to leave the studio.
She's a policy man. These guys with their rules.
So your listeners that want to send a few bucks or a fiver or 10... to Free Radio, what's the address?
The address is Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061, which you can find more easily on the website. Just go to freakradio.org and you'll be able to find out everything you need to know and probably a lot that you don't need to know.
Those with computers.
Nobody cares to know.
And ain't that the truth. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for listening to this particular show in spite of the rude and typical interruptions from certain large, bearded, muscular types who come beefing their way
into the studio,
spitting all over me as I attempt to conclude my show.
Which should have concluded 5 minutes ago.
Power 4 minutes ago, actually. Let's not exaggerate.
Power to
and
the
Lynn
people
is attempting
right
to be the peacemaker
now.
As ever.
What is this, Occupy Free Radio?
Well, there is an idea, actually. It's a good idea, actually. I could do a Vinny on you, if you know what I mean. All right, well, anyway.
Yeah, well, you know how that ended.
I won't get into that. Folks, thanks for listening. You can listen to me again if you'd like. I'll be coming back on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning, and I will be here.